You're listening to CNAS Live, our on-the-go audio version of recent events hosted by the Center for a New American Security. Sanctioning China represents a challenge more complex than any other in the modern era of sanctions. Yet, if tensions with China escalate or conflict appears imminent, U.S. policymakers would reach for the sanctions tool as part of their overall response. Would sanctions work? Could the United States impose harsh sanctions without devastating the U.S. and global economies? Would any allies join the United States in a sanctioning effort? CNAS hosted a virtual conversation on Friday, December 15th, to discuss a new report called No Winners in This Game, Assessing the U.S. Playbook for Sanctioning China, that explores these questions and challenges. Representative Mike Gallagher and Representative Raja Krishnamurthy, who lead the Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party, provided opening remarks and were followed by an expert panel. You can learn more about upcoming events by heading to cnas.org/events. Here's the conversation.
Good morning and welcome to the Center for a New American Security. I'm Emily Kilcrease, Senior Fellow and Director of the Energy Economics and Security Program here at CNAS. We're delighted to be hosting today's event to talk about the recently released CNAS report, No Winners in This Game, Assessing the U.S. Playbook for Sanctioning China. The No Winners report takes a hard look at whether the United States could impose severe sanctions on China in the event of a conflict, and whether it could do so without imposing devastating costs on its own economy or on the global economy. The findings of the report are not encouraging, to say the least. But we also know that policymakers will look to the sanctions tool in the event that conflict appears imminent. And so with that in mind, the report aims to provide a strategic framework that can allow the United States, working closely with its partners and allies overseas, to responsibly plan for economic domain conflict. It also lays out a series of recommendations for how to enhance the U.S. sanctions posture so that economic tools can be integrated with other instruments of national power to maximize the ability to deter China. We have an excellent panel today to dig into the report findings, and we look forward to hearing from the audience with your questions and comments as well. But first, let's look to Congress to get a view on the question of sanctions in China. Earlier this week, the House Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party released a major report of its own, laying out around 150 recommendations on how the United States can succeed in the economic competition with China. We asked committee leadership to share their thoughts on the questions of deterring China from aggression and the role that economic tools can play in an overall strategy to responsibly manage competition, and they graciously agreed to pre-record some thoughts. Let's first hear from Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, who serves as the chairman of the House Select Committee, with his thoughts on these questions.
October, at the 20th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping set a deadline for his generals. Be prepared to invade Taiwan no later than 2027. The lesson of Ukraine is that when autocrats tell you their intentions and mobilize hard power to back it up, you should believe them. But too many Americans, including leading politicians, military leaders, and business executives, do not seem to be taking the CCP seriously. A few months back, the head of a major asset management firm came to my office and told me that the chance of China invading Taiwan in the next 5 years was, and I quote, zero. At the G20, Joe Biden suggested that China's internal economic problems would prevent Xi Jinping from launching a war. As I outlined in the Wall Street Journal, we should not count on Beijing's economic weakness to compensate for a lack of hard power on our side. That view badly misunderstands the nature of the Chinese Communist Party and the history of aggressive authoritarian regimes. Even a cursory examination of the lackluster Russian economy in the lead up to the Ukraine invasion shows that economic weakness may actually increase the likelihood of military action. Nor should we assume sanctions will send the PLA home if they are preparing to cross the Taiwan Strait. Our committee conducted a war game in New York with financial industry leaders that showed economic deterrence could only augment, not substitute, for military power. Our war game also showed that strategic decoupling is a prerequisite for both military and economic deterrence. If the PRC can quickly choke off supplies of life-saving medicine and cripple our critical minerals-dependent supply chains, how credible is our deterrence posture? That's why we need a whole-of-society effort to prevent war, And that means securing the cooperation and expertise of the Fortune 500 boardrooms. American businesses need to take off the golden blindfolds, stop enjoying expensive dinners with Xi Jinping, and open their eyes to the strategic risk of dependence on China. Hardening our economy will involve everyone from manufacturers to tech companies to asset managers, from VIE securities that lack shareholder protections to the risk of asset seizure in the event of conflict. The long-term risk of business in China are far more extensive than many on Wall Street would like to believe. Washington must also recognize the urgent need to revitalize our defense industrial base and surge hard power west of the international dateline before it's too late. That means turning Taiwan into a porcupine and overcoming procurement bottlenecks, which see the island waiting for Harpoon missiles it ordered 3 years ago, if not longer. Our task on the committee is to ensure that when General Secretary Xi Jinping wakes up every morning and looks toward Taiwan, he says to himself, not today.
Sobering words from Representative Gallagher and a good reminder of the whole of society effort that's required to responsibly manage competition with China. Let's turn next to Representative Rajna Krishnamoorthy of Illinois, ranking member of the House Select Committee, for his perspective.
Hi, everybody. I'm Congressman Rajna Krishnamoorthy of the 8th District of Illinois. I'm also the ranking member of the Select Committee on the Strategic Competition with the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP. The CCP Select Committee has done a lot of work in trying to address some of the topics that you are thoughtfully studying today. I want to say a special thank you to CNAS and to congratulate you on the release of the report, No Winners in This Game. And like many of you, we in the Select Committee are trying to do our best to achieve one mission that is unmistakably clear on the part of the American people, which is do not go to an armed conflict with the CCP. Avoid war, avoid armed conflict, avoid a hot war, avoid a cold war. But to do that, we have to make sure that we can deter it. And one of the ways that we can deter it is obviously through military means, but also through economic ones. And I think what you're trying to do through your exercise is to develop ways to sanction China, to engage in peaceful but economic means of deterring conflict. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing the output of your report. I'm looking forward to hearing from you personally as well. And I congratulate you again on all of your efforts. And thank you so much for allowing me to address you virtually.
Thank you to the ranking member and the chairman for their thoughts. It's so critical that the U.S. approaches the competition with China in a thoughtful and bipartisan manner, and we appreciate the leadership that they've both shown on these issues in Congress. Let's get into the conversation now. We're lucky to be joined today by a great panel of experts, including our moderator, Rick Waters. Rick was a longtime foreign service officer with multiple postings in China or China-related positions, including most recently serving as the inaugural coordinator of the China House at the State Department, as well as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for China and Taiwan. Rick, thank you so much for agreeing to be with us today, and I will pass the moderator baton over to you now.
Thanks, Emily, and it's a bit of an auspicious day, both for the release of the report, but also because today is China House's one-year birthday. So let's jump right in. I want to introduce the panel that we have with us, Emily, who needs no introduction, who is the author of the report. John Hughes, our second panelist, who is an adjunct senior fellow with the Energy, Economics, and Security Program at CNAS. Hey, John, he's also a veteran of the State Department's Office of Sanctions Policy, where he's advised a lot of folks, including clients, on sanctions policy and many related issues. And then finally, we've got Emily Jin, our third panelist, who is the research associate at CNAS. Hey, Emily. Her specialization includes China's political economy, financial system, and for those who haven't seen it, she's testified before Congress with some very interesting and thoughtful presentations on Chinese alternatives to the U.S. financial system. So I think today in the panel, what we're going to try to do is to highlight some key takeaways, share some of the report's key recommendations for government officials, both in the U.S. and abroad, as well as for the private sector. But before I get into the discussion, I wanted to highlight a few administrative notes. First, this conversation is public and it will be recorded. It's also being live streamed, and CNAS will post the video after the conclusion of the event. Second, if you want to ask questions, you can either do it through the chat box on the right of the video. It's cnas.org/live. And I think the general practice is not to take anonymous questions, so please use your names. Alternatively, you can tweet your questions using the new hashtag CNAS2023. So throughout the discussion, I'll be on the lookout for your questions and we'll try to feed them in. And if you have any technical issues, please reach out to the comms team at comms, C-O-M-M-S, at cnas.org for support. All right, let's dive right in. So I'll start with Emily. Tell us a little bit about why your research team did this report and what is the central contribution you're trying to make to the policy discussion?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. You know, we started this research project almost 2 years ago at this point. You know, we spent a lot of time in our program and across CNAS, you know, examining the impacts of Russian invasion of Ukraine. We also spent a lot of time thinking about the U.S.-China competition, and I think it became pretty clear to us that it was really understudied how the U.S. and China would think about the use of sanctions in a potential conflict scenario in the future. And to be clear, in our report, we're not saying that China's about to invade Taiwan or that conflict is happening tomorrow, but we recognize that the consequences of conflict, including the economic consequences of the conflict and of any sanctions associated with the conflict, would be super consequential, just given China's integration with the economy, given the size of their economy, the size of their financial sector. And so what we wanted to do with this report was to kind of set a baseline understanding of where the U.S. has options to really levy sanctions. And we use the term sanctions fairly broadly to mean any sort of economic restriction that can be used as a coercive instrument. So we mean financial sanctions, export controls, tariffs, the whole suite of measures that you might think about. So we wanted to put this strategic framework around how the U.S. would think about using sanctions, where those sanctions would actually have some sort of impact, and also think about how China would respond to it. They clearly have their own capacity to retaliate, to defend against U.S. and allied sanctions, and really start to put more depth and rigor behind that analysis, again, with the goal of contributing to the broader picture of what's the U.S. strategic deterrence posture, and what is the role that economic tools play as part of that.
Thanks. John, given your background in the sanctions office, tell us a little bit about the overall challenge of China as a sanctions target.
Sure. Thanks, Rick. And it's really nice to be here with everybody today. So, you know, as you say, Rick, and I think as Emily already noted, China does present a unique sanctions challenge, I think, among all countries around the world, right? If you take a step back and think about what is the point of sanctions as part of an overall foreign policy? And generally speaking, policymakers are trying to use sanctions to advance a foreign policy objective. You're looking at ways that you can try to either change behavior or decision-making in a target country or constrain their ability to engage in activities that might be contrary to your interests. And, you know, the United States has increasingly used this tool, as everybody here knows, around the world over the last number of years. I think China is just inherently different, though. It is, as Emily said, it's a much larger economy, much, much larger than any other economy around the world, other than the U.S., of course. It is also intricately linked with the United States and with the global economy. It is a major exporter, of course, to many countries around the world, including the United States. Really, any actions I think that the United States or our allies were to take against China, particularly more aggressive sanctions, which I think we can talk about later, would almost certainly have a spillover effect both on the United States and on the global economy. And so I think that we just have to be very careful about sort of what the goals are, how we're trying to achieve them, and think about, you know, whether those impacts are greater on us than they might be on China, for example.
Thanks. Emily, I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about the question of leverage. I think one of the real innovations of this report is that the frameworks that you guys have developed might give policymakers a little bit better way of understanding how to think about the question of leverage.
Yeah, so there's two main frameworks that we put forward that we think are helpful for really putting some discipline and rigor around this question of what sanctions should the U.S. consider and what would the impacts of those be. And so the first of these is that we, borrowing very loosely from some of the concepts that occur in military strategic planning, we kind of took some of those concepts related to ends and ways and means and ported them over into what we call the economic domain. And so you can really just think about this to simplify it as, what is the policy objective you're trying to achieve? What are the tools that you have to achieve it? And what are the resources and means available to meet the policy objective? And we really wanted to put it in that kind of disciplined framework because we've got loads of tools, right? We've got broad authorities to issue sanctions, broad authorities to issue export controls. It wasn't as clear to us that if you actually apply it to specific targets, whether that's a sectoral target or a specific company, whether you would actually have much of an impact. And so in the report, by kind of putting this disciplined approach at looking at, you know, ends, ways, and means in the economic domain in three major categories where we look at, you know, efforts to deny technology to China's military, efforts to deny key commodities such as energy, or efforts to place macroeconomic pressure on China, and you look at the tools that you can apply and you look at the specific leverage that the United States has because of the position of its economy relative to China's economy in the global economy, then you can start to get much more precision around what is a sanction that's actually going to be meaningful, what is actually going to apply real pressure, and what is mostly going to be symbolic. And when you put it in that context, you can easily see that, for example, if we're trying to really sanction China's maritime sector, you might be able to do it, but it's unclear that it's going to have any real impact on their naval capabilities in a militarily significant way. You might be able to hit the commercial sector, but we're not sure that's going to translate. And so putting it into that specific framework is a way just to get more, again, precision and detail around how you can think about the impact of the target and really ultimately the pressure that you're able to bear on China's decision making, which is ultimately what sanctions are intended to do. The other framework that we included, and we have lots of tables in the appendices on this that our team worked really hard to put together, so kudos to the whole team on that. We look at specific entities that might be right for a sanctions target, and we examine the extent of their international operations as a proxy to their vulnerability to sanctions pressure. And we identify in the report where we think that, you know, putting a particular company on, for example, the SDN list would be meaningful because they do have that sort of international exposure. But we also found plenty of companies where you can put them on the SDN list or you can put them on the entity list, and maybe we should do it anyways, but it's not clear that it's really going to constrain them in any sort of meaningful way. So in sum, the idea is, like, let's just get very detailed about our targeting efforts when we're thinking about sanctions, and make sure as we think about applying a particular sanction that it's really going to have an impact.
Well, that's a good segue, I think, into a question I have for Emily. If you look at the most potentially impactful sanctions, financial sector sanctions would certainly be at the top of that list. And the debate here is very broad. Some people say you can't blow up the world to save the world. But there is precedent for the use of those tools, even in the China context. Emily, take us through a little bit of how you thought about this question in the development of the report.
Thank you so much, Rick, for that question. Actually, for this report, we did a case study deep dive into some of the financial sector or points of leverage that we, the U.S. government could consider. Specifically, we looked at foreign exchange reserve holdings that China has in the form of U.S. assets, but also other G7 and broader coalition assets. And we developed our own methodology of estimating China's composition of foreign exchange reserves. And we found out that out of China's $3.2 trillion in officially declared foreign exchange reserves, about 56% is actually in U.S. assets. So this really gives the United States an asymmetric leverage, but this leverage could be enhanced if the United States gets broader coalition buy-in. We, from our assessment and estimation, China likely has more than 80% of official foreign exchange holdings and broader coalition assets. And for folks who are interested in the nitty-gritty numbers, please dig into our report. We have these neat little tables that lists the numbers, but also the percentage breakdown. So if we're thinking about from a sanctions efficacy standpoint, it makes a lot more sense if the United States could get political consensus and alignment earlier on in designing a sanctions regime. And while on the topic of financial sector actions or points of leverage, we actually took a deeper dive into China's financial sector by taking inventory of assets and liabilities of China's banking system, the big actors in it. People like one of the most important actors are China's big six banks or big six institutions, these big state-owned commercial banks that are the largest in the entire world. And in addition, we also looked at a select joint stock commercial banks, policy banks, and some sovereign wealth funds as well. Just as an example, out of that those few categories, the five banks out of the big six banks actually have international operations and some foreign exchange exposure, and some limited shares actually held by foreign investors. So sanctioning them, however, would be difficult though, just given the potential ripple effect of trying to take these banks or their operations out of the global financial system. So if we think about from a sanctions implementation standpoint, it likely would not be a surgical move, but have quite a lot of collateral impact that the global markets and payment system cannot easily recover from.
It's a very sobering analysis, Emily. Why don't we turn to John for a second? I know, John, you were involved in some of the previous debates about this inside the U.S. government during the period of tension with China over its Iran energy supplies. Take us through, from the perspective of the report, the energy sector, and how much is the problem of substitutability going to blunt the impact of potential sanctions in that space?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Rick. And I think that the energy sector is really interesting. I mean, unlike what Emily was just describing in the financial sector, you know, on the energy side, of course, you have real tangible assets that are moving around the world. You have oil, you have natural gas, you have pipelines, and you know, there's many different ways that those can be targeted and that have been targeted in the past, as you noted, Rick, for many different countries around the world using sanctions. So many people are familiar over the last decade plus where the US government took significant actions towards Iran, towards more recently Russia, towards Venezuela and others targeting their energy exports. But I would note that in all of those circumstances, those countries are major exporters of energy, particularly oil. In this case of China, we're talking about the opposite, where they are a major importer of energy. And this is not really something that has been targeted at scale before through sanctions. And so there's a number of challenges there. First, on the oil side, as you note, Rick, oil is inherently fungible, substitutable. It can get it from anywhere. And so even if the US were to get a coalition of countries together, for example, to not export oil to China, they might be able to get it from others like Russia or other countries around the world. And you'd have to look at sort of how much that can be substituted and things like that. And then, of course, there's sort of the broader issue around demand. I mean, China really does have a significant amount of the global demand for energy. And so there is also the issue of if you try to get allies on board to say, please do not sell oil to China, then there's sort of a demand collapse and can severely impact those partner economies as well. And so when we talk about this in the report, we think it's important to look at energy holistically. Of course, there's gas as well. There's LNG. There's lots of different angles to this. But sort of one of the key recommendations is that we think that policymakers need to think about sort of novel approaches to energy sanctions. If you look in the Russia context most recently, there's the Russia oil price cap that everybody is aware of and that is currently in effect. That's an example of a novel approach where global oil markets are still functioning, prices have not collapsed, supposed to be constraining Russia's ability to receive revenues. I think on the China side, you need to look at something similar, but again, turning it on its head. How can you provide, for example, incentives to allies such that they might be willing to join a coalition like that where, they could only sell oil to China, for a certain amount or something like that. So these are the sort of things that need to be looked at in the energy context. And it is not as easy as it might have been in some of these other country contexts in the past.
Thanks, John. Emily, you worked a lot in this report on broad sanctions options, by which we mean not just financial blocking sanctions, but export controls and much more. I want to turn for a moment to the export control tool. This tool has been used quite extensively. And what are the lessons that we draw from the use of the tool and your research about its efficacy going forward, the limitations, and the fundamental question of whether it is even possible to deny key technologies to China through the use of export controls?
Yeah, and let's unpack that a little bit. You know, a lot of the framing around our report was trying to think about measures that could be taken in the run-up to a conflict. And we had a high degree of skepticism that export controls could be used effectively in that sort of short-term period, maybe define it as 3 to 6 months. Not to say that we wouldn't do it, but these are the sorts of measures that take a really long time to have effect. And so if you're trying to degrade a technology ecosystem over time, 3 to 6 months just isn't enough time. It's also important to keep in mind, you know, there's already a high level of controls on goods going to China if they have a military purpose, right? Like, we maintain an arms embargo against China. There's, you know, high levels of restrictions on the export of technology to military end uses and end users. We are increasing the amount of commercial or dual use goods that are subject to export controls. And I think that's the direction of travel moving forward on these tools. If we want to think about export controls as a way to deny key technologies to China because they have military or national security significance, it's a long-term effort, and it will necessarily cut deeper into some of these commercial ecosystems. Again, because we're already controlling the like kind of purely military stuff. And so you can think about efforts such as the October 7th export controls imposed by the US government, really focused on freezing in place China's advanced chip capability, their supercomputing ability, their AI capabilities. And when you put it in this framework of what can we do to deny technology to China, it's those sorts of measures. And we can debate whether they've been effective. We can debate whether that's an appropriate use of the export controls. But you can clearly see some sort of logic there of, if we think that chips, if we think that AI is going to be important for China's military moving forward, and we know that these measures take a long time to have effect, then there's a rationale for taking some of those actions now. Now, the trick, of course, is how to do this in a way that's sustainable for US competition, for US firms who have been relying on the China market, right? Like, it's not an easy answer to just cut off some of these technology exports to China. But clearly there is a case, we think there is a case for really taking a hard look across a range of technology classes to see where it would make sense, where US leadership would be enhanced by more export controls, and how we can do that, keeping in mind that it's a long burn for these sorts of tools.
That's really helpful, Emily. I mean, one quick follow-up, because I want to turn in a second to the economic game that you guys ran, mm-hmm. but is there a distinction in your analysis between things the U.S. will do anyway because there are national security or human rights-related imperatives in the export control space, and the use of that tool for deterrence purposes?
Yes, I think there's probably a lot of overlap there when you think about it. But when you're thinking about, you know, for example, the use of export controls for human rights, you're going to be looking at potentially a different class of technologies. You're going to be not as necessarily laser focused on the direct contribution that these technologies can make to the PLA and PLA capabilities, particularly those capabilities that would be most relevant in, for example, a conflict over Taiwan where they might be up against the US military, right? Like, if you are really concerned about these potential future conflict scenarios, you are going to be laser focused on the set of technologies that matters in that sort of context. It is true that we are in the US thinking about a broader range of policy objectives for which export controls might be suitable, including human rights, including you know, other foreign policy objectives. Those might look a little bit different than what we're thinking about in this kind of more dire situation of a technology denial effort in a potential lead up to conflict.
That's really helpful. Well, let's turn now to the economic game simulation that you guys ran. I think this was one of the most interesting parts of the report, trying to model the behavior of the U.S., China, and third actors in a crisis scenario. Why don't we start with Emily, but I'd like to hear from all of you on various aspects of the lessons from this economic game experiment. Emily, tell us a little bit more about the overall game design, and what were the big picture takeaways?
Yeah, so this was a fun part of the research. We developed and executed a game we called the Locked Horns game, which is an economic domain strategy game. And what we were trying to do in this particular game was to examine how the U.S. and China and U.S. partners would think about the use of sanctions if they're given kind of best case scenario sanctions conditions, right? So in the game, we said the U.S. economy was healthy, inflation was low, China's economy was more or less on the same track it's on now, so certainly having some structural difficulties. The U.S. and its partners were aligned, they'd been thinking about these issues, right? We're trying to set up a really strong case for where we can kind of get around some of the issues that we know exist in the real world, but just to really examine the use of the sanctions instrument and how far up a sanctions escalation ladder the U.S. and its partners would be willing to go when they're giving clear instructions to use the tool, but also to mitigate the damage that the use of the tool would cause on their own economies. And so that was the overall design of the game. We ran the game once in DC and once in Brussels because we know that the perceptions, certainly in Europe, of these questions will be a little bit different. Although I think we were surprised that there were more commonalities across the games than differences for the most part. And for me, and I welcome Emily and John's thoughts on this too, you know, I think one of the most striking things that came out of the game, which included, you know, sanctions experts, macroeconomists, industry folks, private sector folks, China geopolitical experts, you know, so we tried to get the right people in the room. But one of the interesting observations, which led to a lot of the analysis in the report, which was that only really big sanctions are going to be meaningful. Like, there was a really high degree of skepticism that limited sanctions are going to have any sort of impact on Chinese decision making. And so players in the game really quickly went all the way up the escalation ladder, including to kind of Russia plus style measures where you're talking about sanctions on the big banks, you're talking about trade embargoes, because that's what they felt they would have to do in order for this tool to have an effect on Chinese decision making. Now, I will say in the hot wash, a lot of the players went, whoa, that was a lot. I'm not sure we would do that in real life. And so that's an important lesson for us to take away from those games as well.
Well, and that's a good segue. You know, John, you worked a lot in the sanctions office on these issues. Drawing on your past experience, what are some takeaways from the game that stuck with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of them. And Emily highlighted one of the main ones, which is, again, that, you know, I think a lot of people thought that going very high up the escalation ladder very quickly was really the only way to be effective. But I think there's sort of a related point there that really is threefold. It goes to the intersection of deterrence, timing, and sequencing. So if you think about sanctions policy generally, and including in this situation, you know, of course, the goal is not to go into a conflict. You want to try to use the threat of sanctions as a potential deterrent to that. And I think that, you know, in the case of the report and in the game itself, we looked at this, and there's always this inherent lag in that, you know, you want to be very clear in your deterrence posture and be very clear on the types of sanctions that you're willing to impose. You want to make sure that you have all your ducks in a row. You have to be willing to then follow through with them once you have done that. And I think importantly, you need to have allies on board as well, because one part of the game that was clear was that without having allies on board, you know, it's unclear if China would, you know, take the threat as seriously. The problem is that, and this came up in the game, and I think is true in real life as well, is that politically, it's often very hard for countries to do that and to have the political will to say, yes, we're definitely going to go full scale on sanctions towards China before a conflict has happened, right? Often it's not until, you know, the 12th hour, so to speak, or even as the conflict is beginning, where that political consensus emerges. And so there's a mismatch there between sort of what we thought was necessary in the game versus what actually happened in the game on deterrence. Then there's sort of a separate issue around timing of sanctions impacts. And this is also something that you see throughout sanctions programs around the world and would be true in this case. Sanctions take a long time to have any sort of meaningful impact, right? It's not like you can impose a sanction on day one and it will, you know, the next day have those impacts on the target that you're looking for. Certainly there would be many impacts on the global economy, as we've already discussed. But, you know, for example, if you're trying to impede China's decision making, sometimes you don't see those ripple effects through their economy for a number of months or even years. And so there's a timing issue there too, where there might be some misperceptions if China does not actually see the impact that the sanctions are aiming to achieve. It may not actually be willing to stop what it's doing. So that's another issue there. And then the last is on sequencing. And, you know, this goes back to Emily's point where in a traditional sanctions scenario, you know, sanctions experts will talk about an escalatory ladder and moving up that ladder and making sure that you have additional sanctions actions that you can take depending on how things go. And, you know, sort of that threat of ongoing sanctions as well as the ability to move back down the ladder, you know, if needed. But to Emily's point, it's not really accurate in this case, because again, in the game, we found that everybody thought that you sort of had to start at the top of that escalatory ladder. And then the question becomes, well, what's next, right? If it doesn't, if it fails to achieve your goals, there's not really anything left at that point to continue to go up. And so, you know, that's another factor that policymakers would have to consider when, you know, if this were to become reality.
Thanks, John. For Emily, Jen, you know, I want to turn back for a brief moment to the specific issue of how financial sanctions played during the simulation. Tell us a little bit about how the China team reaction was modeled and what happened to, you know, U.S. companies and others as a result of their counter sanctions response.
Sure, Rick. So the China teams in both iterations of this economic game actually could not come up with meaningful countermeasures in the financial realm. So it didn't have really the means for tit for tat in the financial realm, but it ended up retaliating by pressuring foreign firms operating in China. A lot of it probably modeled on real life events that's happening prior to the scenarios that we organized. So this actually ended up backfiring on the China teams because these pressure operations, if you will, ended up spurring more consensus in the non-China teams and essentially encouraged the non-China teams to cooperate a little bit more early on. There's some leverage that the China team had. There's some level of foreign participation in the Chinese domestic bond and equity markets. Like portfolio inflows from foreign investors have like risen in recent years, but that level of foreign participation overall is small. So it's not like the PRC financial leverage there is significant. And overall, the PRC just does not have enough leverage in the global financial system to have a proportional response in that realm. But if we kind of take a step back and look beyond the game, in reality, China has tools way beyond the economic and financial realm. It could, for example, deploy cyber attacks to retaliate against US and partner and allied country actions. So unfortunately, in reality, it's not like our economic game where non-economic tools were not encouraged.
Thanks. I think it would be good to spend a little bit of time on the report recommendations, but before I ask each of you to comment on the ones that you think were the most important, I want to just refer to a couple of the questions from the chat box that we've received, and maybe as we go around, you can tailor your responses to some of these points. One of the questions that came in is, you know, the U.S. is, as I understand it, doesn't currently have the authorities in many cases to use at least financial blocking sanctions against China. So is there an issue of authorities, and how in the framework you developed would the promulgation of new authorities or the passage of legislation factor into both deterrence and other policy goals? A second question that came in, or sort of an interrelated one, is the degree to which the U.S. and its allies and partners are discussing both reducing dependence on China in anticipation of some of the implicit scenarios you describe, and then the question of coordination on sanctions themselves, broadly defined. Where do those conversations stand, and who are the key addresses? Because not every capital matters. I mean, even as we know in the EU, export control and sanctions authorities are divided between member nations and Brussels. And then a final question that came in is the question about how research of this type might be perceived by Beijing. I mean, even the title of the game, No Winners, what signal do you intend to send to your, you know, research counterparts in Beijing through the issuance of this report? So those are a few things that we can comment on. I'm going to start with Emily Jin, and we'll go in the opposite order. Go ahead.
I think I'll attempt the last question, actually, in terms of the perception piece, and I'll leave it out to my capable colleagues to address the other sticky questions. So, wow, what an inventory of questions. I think with this research, I think overall the theme of this event is it's a sobering picture for everybody involved, including nation states that have quite a lot of leverage, which United States is one of them, but also allies and partners in the European Union, for example, but also some allies and partners in Indo-Pacific. I think the point is, for at least this kind of research, the purpose is to make sure that policymakers can make responsible and evidence-based, fact-based research that undergirds policymaking, and perhaps not rush into a conflict without understanding the action-reaction cycle that may come from a sanctions regime or sanctions action, but also potential ripple effects. Some of them might be anticipated, but some might be unintended and unanticipated. So hopefully I've done this report's title justice, but I'll hand it off to my colleagues, Emily or John, if you wanted to hop in.
Yeah,
John, go ahead.
I'm happy to take a couple more of those. I think Emily Jin is absolutely correct. So on a couple of the other questions, maybe I'll address those and then I'll turn to Emily Kilcrease to round us out. First, on the question of sanctions authorities, I actually don't think that's an issue. The U.S. government has a number of sanctions authorities in place, as you know, some in this call may know. You know, under something called IEPA, the U.S. executive branch is able to impose sanctions on, able to declare a national security emergency and then impose sanctions and other measures based on that emergency. You know, I think, in my view, I don't think it would be an issue to sort of justify taking that action if needed. And then, of course, noting that our congressional colleagues were on earlier, there's, of course, a large role for Congress to play here as well. And certainly Congress, if they wanted, could give that ability as well. And there are certain sanctions authorities that Congress has already put in place that could be potentially relevant here. But I think broadly speaking, the U.S. government has these sanctions authorities it needs if it needed to take these steps. So that's on that question. I think on the other one, on coordination, this is really interesting and actually one that came in both in the game and in the report itself. And as you say, Rick, sort of what are the key addresses that the U.S. government would need to talk to? I think to me, it's really important to think about this as a really a global approach. Often in sanctions programs, we talk about coordination with key allies, right? What does that mean, right? And really what we're talking about there is sort of, you know, G7 and other major economies that have either the financial capitals or, you know, major buying power, major export power, et cetera, that really can have the ability to impose meaningful sanctions. And so certainly in the case of this, you want to talk about, you know, of course, want to have the EU itself on board, as well as key member states within the EU. As Rick notes, it's not always, depends. For example, on export controls, you need to have some individual countries on board as well. You want to have the United Kingdom as well on board, you know, Japan, other G7, and other allies. But I think another key point here, and this is where I want to sort of emphasize, this is really important and something that hasn't always been done in the past, is around coordinating with the sort of the broader global South, right? There's a number of countries around the world that have key trading relationships with China, are major importers from China. And, you know, candidly, because of that, it makes it more challenging to potentially get them on board for something like this. But I think also the U.S. government has not always been great in the past at sort of going to those key countries outside of the G7 to have those conversations early, to talk about, you know, what are the positive ways that countries could work together, for example, around resiliency efforts that could maybe make it easier to get those countries on board down the road. And so I think that sort of thinking is crucial here, and that this does need to be a much, much broader global diplomatic approach than it might have been in other sanctions programs in the past.
Emily, we'll let you close out the recommendations portion. What were the kind of bigger picture institutional and international recommendations that you felt were the most important?
Yeah, it follows nicely from the comments that, John and Emily Jin made. You know, one of the big themes in the recommendations is that we need to be prepared. When you think about the complexities of trying to sanction China at scale, you know, if that is something policymakers at some point in the future decide is warranted, it'll be massively expensive. It'll be massively complicated. And so one main theme of our recommendations is that within the United States government, within the U.S. economic agencies, it's not so much authorities, as John was pointing out, but it's having a strategy and having a plan and having a planning process where you can really game it out. We obviously have a bias towards gaming. We think it's a really helpful tool, but that's where you start to find some of those seams, right? Like you start to understand the consequences of certain choices. And we think just having those sorts of processes within the economic agencies is super important. But then you need to integrate that with the rest of the interagency, right? How do we think about layering economic tools into a broader integrated deterrence strategy that actually integrates all of these different tools and levers? And then to the point about allies and partners, we then need to do these same sorts of strategic planning exercises and thought exercises with our key partners and allies while doing the outreach to partners around the globe. And, you know, on that authorities question, like I agree with John that in the US, it's not as much of a problem. We do know that in partners and allies overseas, sometimes it can be more of a problem. There's certainly capacity issues in a lot of our partner country governments in terms of just the number of people they have doing sanctions implementation, doing sanctions targeting and the like. Those are the sorts of things it would be good to find out before you're in a major sanctions effort. And so we see a lot of value in building that muscle now, building those connections now, to the extent that there are distinctions in authorities or capacity gaps. Find that out now through a really robust effort of the United States and its partners to really think these things through. There's also a huge role for the private sector in all of this. We know that companies are starting to think about this more seriously. They're thinking about de-risking. I think they're thinking about the kind of more dire situations as well. But as the US government and partner governments try to plan for these sorts of scenarios, having that sort of regular dialogue with the private sector is going to be absolutely essential so that the government is making decisions and making plans based on the best available information, and that private sector companies can start to bake this into their decision making. It really does need to be this two-way street of information so that all sectors, public sector and private sector, have a game plan. Hopefully you never use it, but you need to be prepared.
That's really great, guys. Well, look, there are a few other questions that have come in from the chat, and I think we have about 10 more minutes, so if anyone else wants to submit a question, we've got a bit of time left. I wanted to highlight one that I think is a subject of a lot of concern among both you know, institutional and corporate investors, as well as some governments right now. It's the question of, you know, if we were in Beijing right now having this discussion, what would it look like? And how do we understand some of the things that are already going on the Chinese side in anticipation of conversations like this? Increasing gold reserves, the efforts to strengthen digital currency, the dual circulation model and indigenous innovation, sanctions insulation, and finally, the BRICS discussions that have been underway. In the aggregate, What is the picture that you guys see emerging from Beijing on this question? And what lessons or conclusions should we deduce from that?
I could potentially jump in first, but maybe then John and Emily Cook.
Yeah, whoever wants to come in.
I know you mentioned a couple of things like dual circulation, BRICS, digital currency. All of them kind of speaks to China's strategy of planning for alternatives in terms of alternative financial pipelines, but also kind of a alternative plan in case of the worst case scenario where something kinetic happens or that the two great powers engages in some kind of conflict. So I think while worst case planning is arguably, it is responsible statecraft, right, by any nation state. At the same time, I think policymakers would should remember that ultimately it is about understanding what having a fact-based evidence analysis side by side of the United States and China's leverage, points of leverage, but also points of vulnerability and making responsible statecraft from there. But I think it is interesting, certainly, to see all of the developments that are coming out of China about like dual circulation, which is aimed at bolstering its own domestic capability, technological capability, while still trying to rely on the exports piece to buoy its economy, right? So there's a little bit of, it is sensible statecraft, but at the same time, it does seem to point to a direction of worst case scenario planning.
Yeah, so maybe I'll chime in now on top of that, Rick. So, you know, I think you make a great point on these questions. And just to note that, of course, this is a two-way street, right? This is not just about what the United States is doing, right? China obviously is doing other things, as you noted, and Emily's talked about some of that. I would just say that, like, some of that is out of our control, of course, but some of it isn't. And, you know, you need to look at actions that the U.S. can take that, you know, if you think about resiliency, which is another key theme of our report. I mean, all the questions you're talking about, Rick, really are around Chinese resiliency. You know, I would argue that one way to counter that is to focus on even better U.S. and allied resiliency, right? And so there are some efforts that are being made now in that space already. So you look at, you know, especially coming out of COVID and things like that, where, you know, the U.S. and other governments have been looking at supply chains and ways that they can build redundancies, you know, reduce dependencies on China, maybe build up export capacity in other countries, all those sort of things that the U.S. continues to do. And I think in our report, we talk about how that, you know, they need to double down on that and continue to build up those resiliencies. You know, another example would be if there are, you know, single source products you're getting from China, you know, look at where else you might be able to get those, things like that. And the more that can be done on that now, you know, this is a direct link to sanctions policy. The more resilient you are in your own economy, sort of the higher up that escalation ladder that you can go. And so I think that's an important point of the report, is that, you know, we need to focus on our own resiliency efforts. But then there are other things that the U.S. can do that also go directly to sort of some of the things you're talking about. In particular, you know, we talk about the primacy of the U.S. dollar, and one of the main reasons why the U.S. government is, you know, able to use sanctions so effectively around the world is because of the central role of the U.S. dollar in the global financial system, as well as, you know, uses for international trade. And we talk in the report about how there are steps that can be taken to shore that up, right? So, of course, China is looking at ways that they can circumvent that. There are also ways the U.S. government can do to make sure that central role remains, you know. So, for example, you can talk about how you know, sanctions have become, you know, one of the main foreign policy tools of choice. You know, we talk about in the report that you should sort of hold off on doing some of those major financial sanctions against China until absolutely necessary, because you don't want to erode their effectiveness, right? And you want to make sure that, you know, that the U.S. economy, the dollar, is a place that investors want to continue to invest in. You know, it's a safe haven during times of crisis. You know, there are economic steps that can be taken and that are taken on a regular basis to ensure that continues to be the case. And, you know, I think we often talk about that as sort of a separate issue than sanctions, but really it's interrelated, right? The more that you can focus as policymakers and working with the economic agencies and, you know, and others on, you know, maintaining the centrality of the U.S. dollar in the global economy, that's also a resiliency measure that makes it harder for China to take some of these steps that you're talking about.
Yeah, maybe let me just emphasize one point that was embedded in John's comments, because I think it's really important. Like, there's been a lot of discussion around China's development of alternative financial rails, and we do think that's a really important thing to keep an eye on. We've written reports on that. We've got another one coming out. But the point is that China today still has a really strong economic incentive to remain integrated into the current system that is dominated by the U.S. dollar. And it is our strategic interest to retain their integration into that system. It's good for economic efficiency, including for the United States, but it also is, we think, one of the strongest points of leverage that the United States would have if we were in this situation where we needed to impose really strong sanctions. And so we're right to like where we are today. I think that means that there's a strong case for restraint on using the financial sanctions tool specifically, because when you look at overall our leverage, it is more mixed and modest than we would like it to be. We've got one point of leverage that is quite strong, and it's our view that we need to retain that leverage because it's quite important.
That's great, Emily. Well, look, in the few minutes we have left, I'd like to give each of you a chance to offer your final conclusions your thoughts about where you're going to go next. Emily, you talked a little bit about where this project might go, but, you know, specific scenarios, I think, that are in the works. And we might want to also touch on a few of the other questions that came in, one of which had to do with the assumption check on, you know, how likely it is to use this. I think these tools, I think, Emily, you hinted at that a little bit, but I think maybe what would be good is to remind folks of the precedent that has been deployed so far against China, how far that's gone, and, you know, what that tells us about this question that's in the chat. And one final thing, and I think it gets to the institutional issues that Emily has touched on. How confident are you that the U.S. government currently has the institutional abilities within the departments to cost out and develop the policies as you describe? So why don't we start with Emily Kay, and we'll go back around for one last round of concluding thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a big picture response there is that it's important to remember that we're already in a deterrence period, right? And, you know, when you think about it in that context, there are some of these actions that we should be taking now, right? I talked earlier about kind of long-term technology denial and export control efforts. You know, I think there's an important role right now for signaling unity and cohesion with allies on China policy, broadly speaking. You know, I think it's another step, and perhaps for some of our allies right now, a step too far to signal clarity on specific sanctions with respect to Taiwan, for example, right? But I do think that efforts like, for example, the G7 statement on economic security and resiliency is important to show, you know, that there's kind of this emerging consensus, and that will continue to be important. And so we don't want people to come away from this thinking that, okay, well, when we think there's going to be a problem, that's when we'll start thinking about deterrence. It's now, because the resiliency efforts, the long-term kind of technology operations, the coordination with allies, that is all stuff that needs to already be happening. And so we certainly want people to be thinking about that as well. In terms of where we go next with this research, we've already started on the next phase of the work related to this question. The No Winners Report was primarily scenario agnostic. We were trying to level set on how these tools might be used and where there's leverage. But of course, an immediate question we got from a lot of readers was, well, what does this mean for Taiwan, or what does this mean for the Philippines? And yes, we get that that's an important question. So the next phase of research, we're looking specifically at Taiwan. We also want to do more thinking on kind of the left of boom scenario. So if there's, you know, escalation, but it's not at the level of embargo or invasion, how do we think about the use of tools there? Is there a way that we can use some of these tools, particularly in the financial sector, sanction space, to build credibility of the U.S. threat? You know, I think that credibility of the threat is a big question that we want to get into over the next phase of research as well. So there's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of other think tanks that we're coordinating with this on, because it's an enormous question. And so we're certainly happy to stay in touch with the audience as we continue moving forward on this.
John, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Yeah, so maybe a couple final thoughts from me. One, building off of Emily's point on how they're sort of already in a deterrence posture. You know, I would say on the question of institutional capabilities, you know, I would argue that the U.S. government certainly has a lot of experience in this space. And if you look at over the last, you know, 15 or so years, has really done a lot in the broader sanctions space against a number of countries around the world, as everybody knows. And has learned a lot of good lessons from all those different approaches. And, you know, most recently, of course, with Russia being, you know, to date, sort of one of the biggest economies that have been targeted by a major sanctions program. And, you know, you look at the U.S. approach there, and, you know, really coordination with allies was key in signaling what they're planning to do and all of that that sort of hadn't always happened as much in the past. And so I think you can see this evolution of lessons learned, that the U.S. government already has that ability and they can draw on all those lessons for this. And then, of course, in the China context, as you know well, Rick, there are a number of China experts, certainly in the U.S. government and outside the U.S. government. And, you know, as Emily said, there are already efforts being undertaken. There's been a lot of work in the last few years on export controls in particular, novel export control approaches, you know, looking now at outbound investments and other tools that could be potentially used in a China context. And I think, you know, there is work already being done. So I don't think it's a matter of institutional capacity. You know, I think it's more around just, you know, understanding the scope and scale of this issue and making sure that you're pulling in the the right people across the board to think about it now, including allies and partners. And then maybe that just leads to my last point, which is that, as Emily noted, you know, there are a number of others working on these issues, of course. And, you know, I really think that this requires a multi-stakeholder approach, right? It's, you can't just have a number of sanctions experts in the US government talk about this and that's enough, right? You need to have many other experts around the US government. You need to have allied governments. You need to have think tanks, you know, other experts outside. Emily noted before the private sector and the crucial role that that they play. And of course, the impact that they have, that it has on them. And of course, also their expertise, right? Oftentimes, it is the companies themselves that know a lot more about these specific issues than government officials. So it's important to have that dialogue. Same thing goes in the financial sector where, you know, banks are very well placed to talk about the impact of financial sanctions and, you know, with all the experience they've had on this over the years. And so having those types of conversations now and, you know, not being shy to do that rather than, you know, sort of keeping this in a silo and saying that we have to do sort of secret planning, right? That in my view, that doesn't work. So you need to have these types of conversations now and making sure that you're having the right people in the room.
I'm going to sound like I'm repeating essentially the themes that Emily and John has brought up. Here we go. So I am actually quite confident that the US government has the capacity, especially like if, for example, one of the objectives that, or recommendations we had was to prepare for macroeconomic pressure operations. So Emily and John have already said to do so, it's one of the key things is to preserve the role of the US dollar and the strength of it in the global financial system. What this could look like is, you know, U.S. government should strive to be steady-handed in implementing its financial sanctions. Should only be used when the U.S. government determines it's like absolutely necessary and will have the maximal impact. But other ideas that we put forth is the U.S. government should work with partners on both Capitol Hill, but also financial regulatory agencies, just to make sure that U.S. markets are stable. To make sure that the U.S. is demonstrating domestic economic and financial strength. And there's some other ideas too in the report and our overall research that the United States and its partners and allies should also strengthen coordinated efforts in financial technology innovation, build off existing frameworks for digital assets and track the evolution of other countries that are developing their own alternatives. This can ensure that other countries don't have pressure release valves from sanctions via these alternative routes. And these to-do list items, if you will, for U.S. economic and financial policy, but also broader foreign policy, they're not easy, but they're necessary to ensure that the United States is in and its partners and allies are in the strongest position in terms of their collectively shared economic security and national security.
All right, guys. Well, a really terrific report. Congratulations to all of you for pulling it together. It's a huge contribution to the debate. I'd also like to thank the CNAS comms team and Jasmine for pulling together the mechanics of this panel, which I'm sure many people will view even after it's no longer live. And a big thank you to the select committee members, to Representative Mike Gallagher and to Rajna Krishnamurthy for their support as well. So I wish you all a happy holidays, and again, congratulations on a tremendous contribution.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CNAS Live, a production of the Center for a New American Security. This episode was produced by Anna Peterson and Charles Horn, with design help from Melody Cook and Ren Rothback. Please rate and subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts.